A man had two sons. He came to the first and said, "Son, go out and work in the vineyard today." He said in reply, "I will not." But afterwards he changed his mind and he went. The man came to the other son and gave him the same order. He said in reply, "Yes, sir," but did not go. Which of the two did his father's will? They answered, "The first." Whenever I hear confessions from children, you parents will be happy to know that one of the most common sins that they relate is that they don't obey their parents as they should. I'm just looking over there. After I explain to them why their parents ask them to do things, I relate this parable to them, and I tell them it's much better to be that first son that feels bad and feels guilty and then eventually does what the parents ask. But before I go on, I want to put this parable, this gospel, in its context. It's spoken by Jesus at the very end of his ministry. He is in Jerusalem when he's giving this, and in 1 week he'll be crucified, which alerts me that today's parable carries additional and serious weight and serious meaning for us as well. It is directed, Jesus does, at the church authorities and calls into question two types of resistance to God and his will. The first son resists through probably self-interest and just laziness. But the first son has a conscience and eventually causes him to do his father's will. It is to the second son that I wish to speak about. The one who says yes and then does not listen and does not do it. This is a much more dangerous person because it involves death. And a death worse than any natural death, the death of a conscience. As a physician and a priest, I've witnessed many people die. As a doctor and a priest, I've witnessed only a few who, although they're alive, have a dead conscience. It was about 25, I'm sure it was later than 25 years ago. Might even have been as long as 35 years ago. I was a young doctor starting out in our practice, and as is very common with hospitals, they have a call schedule for unattended parents, unattended patients that come in that don't have a doctor in the hospital. And being on that call schedule is actually beneficial for a new doctor because it's a way of us getting new patients because they are often are new in a neighborhood or things like that. So it was one of those nights when I got called because of a delivery of a baby, premature baby, who was in trouble. The police had brought the mother in because she was in jail. And the baby was not doing well. And I went and I talked to the mother. And I said to her, trying to get medical history, talking, because nobody knew, I knew nothing about her at all. Finding out if there's been any problems during pregnancy, what's going on. But she'd been in the jail because of drugs. So I asked her, I said, "Have you taken any drugs lately? I know you're in the hospital, you're in the jail for drugs." And she said, no. And me being naive, I thought, well, you know what? She's in jail. Where do you get drugs in jail? A little to find out that there's probably more drugs in jail than there are outside. So I didn't think anything of it. Okay, fine, thank you. So I went back, and part of our routine blood tests are that we just measure for drugs in baby systems. And so as I sent that off with all the other tests, the baby was not doing well, got worse. And so I was more concerned about it, and I went back to her and I said, "You know, your baby's not doing well, and it would be very important for us to know what's going on. So I'm just going to ask you one more time. I know it's not, I won't say anything. I just need to know, for your baby's sake, have you taken any drugs?" And she looked at me and she said, "No, no." So I went back and I took care of the baby for another couple of hours. And the results of the drug test came back that within the baby's system was unmetabolized cocaine, which means that she must have taken it minutes to an hour maybe before the delivery. How she got it, I don't even know. She was in the hospital. But in her baby's system was unmetabolized cocaine. So I thought, I got you now. I thought I was so righteous back then. I was so young. I went back and calmly and nonchalantly said to her, "You know, I'm coming a third time. I just need to ask you one more time because your baby's not well. And it's really important that we know, especially if you've taken any drugs. So I really need to know, did you take any drugs?" And just like St. Peter, she denied it a third time. She looked and said, "No, I haven't taken any drugs. Why would I? I was in jail." And I said, "Well, that's just curious, because we found unmetabolized cocaine in your baby's blood." She didn't cry, the mother. She didn't put her head down. She didn't look ashamed. She didn't get angry. She looked at me with dead eyes. And I don't know if you've ever seen just dead eyes, that behind there was no conscience. She said nothing. She just looked at me. She just looked at me with those dead eyes. And I knew that I saw somebody whose conscience is dead. I'll never forget that look in her eyes. Now, I knew the ravages of addiction, but I never thought that a person can abandon that primal relationship, one I thought that would never be broken, a mother's devotion to her child. I had seen someone, and like I said, a face I'll never forget, one in whom the addiction and the choices that were made had killed that great gift we have all been given, our conscience. Our ability to feel guilty when doing something wrong. How does a conscience die? Well, I know of two ways. A conscience can bleed to death, or a conscience can starve to death. Whichever it is, both are slow deaths. They don't happen suddenly. And here's how it happens. We each contain three selves, three persons, sort of, in our being. The first is the outside self that we show to others. And although it takes a great deal of our mental energy, we display to others the self we want them to see. We want to leave others with a good impression about ourselves. It's sort of the stage self, the self we put on like we're on stage, like we're on a show. The second person in us is a private self. That's when we are by ourselves, we do things that we would never do if people were looking at us. Yet there's a third person in us, in our inner self. That's the one we don't want to often face up to, the one that we keep hidden and locked up, one in which if we did look, it would force us to take a good hard look at what we really are before God and why. It's that third self that dies when our conscience dies. And as I said, it's slow and it's an avoidable death. It starts when we see our conscience and our obedience to God as an annoyance instead of a guilt, instead of a gift. We get annoyed that we are feeling guilty for the sins that we're doing. Addictions are the classic and the most common example. Our brains through addiction are altered and our resolve is lowered, and we return to harmful behaviors because we're just too weak, yet we're still ashamed of ourselves. We are continuously offered through our consciences a different voice and a different choice. And instead of listening, we get annoyed. And after ignoring that voice long enough, it gets a little bit quieter, but it doesn't disappear. If we continue down the path of sin, our annoyance changes to anger. We become angry that we still have these pains of guilt. Can't my conscience just leave me alone? Our anger drives the voices of our conscience further away. Then it quiets, and then it dies. Then sin becomes all right to the person. They no longer feel they have to justify their actions in their minds. There's no longer an inner battle between good and evil. They finally believe wrong is right for me. In this condition, there's no way that God's truth can reach them. With the death of their conscience, they have willfully put themselves in a condition of unavailability to the Spirit. The Holy Spirit conveys truth, helps us grasp that truth, and moves our will towards that truth. The Holy Spirit is divine nourishment for our consciences. And with the death of our conscience, the price is much higher than we thought. With its death, so dies faith, hope, and love. We become what Mother Teresa called the poorest of the poor. I wish I could give you a happy ending to my story. I, by chance, did run into this mother during the course of several years, but I never spoke to her. I don't know if she ever got her baby back that was taken from her. I don't know if she ever kicked her habit. When I did see her, she had a job, and she looked much better. But like I said, I saw her, and she noticed me, but we never spoke. What would be the point? No matter what she said, I couldn't believe her. That's the price paid. So I continue, and I have prayed for her, that God cared for her, and that she too experienced resurrection from the dead.